version of Benjamin Rush, a lovable gadfly with close personal ties to the Adams family, but with ideological convictions that floated in unpredictable patterns over the entire political landscape. The most recent breezes had carried him into the Republican camp as a staunch defender of the French Revolution, which was the chief reason Abigail thought that Jerry had a kink in his head. Adams himself warned Jerry not to confuse what was happening in France with the American Revolution. "The French are no more capable of a Republican government," he insisted, "than a snowball can exist a whole week in the streets of Philadelphia under a burning sun." Despite Abigail's reservations, Adams wanted Jerry on the peace delegation to demonstrate his bipartisan principles and also to assure that he would receive candid reports from a trusted friend. Second, he appointed John Quincy as American minister to Prussia. His son objected, protesting that the appointment would surely be criticized as an act of nepotism and would fuel charges that Adams was grooming an heir for the presidency. "Your reasons will not bear examination," Adams retorted. "It is the worst-founded opinion I ever knew you to conceive." This was vintage Adams' bravado, shouting his denial at political advice he knew to be sound, refusing to listen because it was patently political and merely self-protective. Mostly, he wanted John Quincy located in one of the diplomatic capitals of Europe as his own personal listening post. "I wish you to continue your practice of writing freely to me," he wrote, then added, "and more cautiously to the Office of State." He would be his own Secretary of State and trust his son's quite impressive knowledge of European affairs more than official reports. Both of these decisions paid dividends the following year, when the prospects for an outright declaration of war against France looked virtually certain. The ever-agile and forever unscrupulous Talleyrand, Foreign Minister of France, had refused to receive the American peace delegation and had then sent three of his operatives to demand a bribe of £50,000 sterling as the prerequisite for any further negotiations. When Adams received word of this outrageous ultimatum, he ordered the delegation to return home, but he also withheld the official dispatches describing the bribery scheme from the Congress and the public. Abigail described this decision as a very painful thing because the president could not play his strongest card. But Adams knew that popular reaction to what became known as the XYZ affair after the three French operatives would be virulently patriotic and intensely belligerent. By delaying publication of the dispatches, he bought time, and during that time, Jerry, always the maverick, had opted to remain in Paris to confer unofficially with French diplomats about averting the looming war. His reports home counseled patience, based on the growing recognition within the directory that the bribery demand had been a terrible miscalculation. John Quincy's network of European sources also urged enlightened procrastination. Despite considerable pressure from the Federalists in Congress and mounting war fever in the wake of the XYZ revelations, Adams held out hope for reconciliation based primarily on these reports. Abigail was his chief domestic minister without portfolio. In a very real sense, Adams did not have a domestic policy, indeed believed that paying any attention to the shifting currents of popular opinion and the raging party battles in the press violated his proper posture as president, which was to remain oblivious to such swings in the national mood. Abigail tended to reinforce this belief in executive independence. Jefferson, she explained, was like a willow who bent with every political breeze. Her husband, on the other hand, was like an oak. "He may be torn up by the roots, he may break, but he will never bend." Nevertheless, she followed the highly partisan exchanges in the Republican newspapers and provided her husband with regular reports on the machinations and accusations of the opposition. When an editorial in the Aurora described Adams as old, garrulous, bald, blind, and crippled, she joked that she alone possessed the intimate knowledge to testify about his physical condition. Popular reaction to the XYZ affair generated a surge of hostility toward French supporters in America, and Abigail noted with pleasure the appearance of William Cobbett's anti-Jefferson editorials in Porcupine's Gazette, where Jefferson was described as head of the Frenchified faction in this country and a leading member of the American Directory. She relished reporting the 4th of July toast, "John Adams, may he, like Samson, slay thousands of Frenchmen with the jawbone of Jefferson." She passed along gossip circulating in the streets of Philadelphia about plans to mount pro-French demonstrations allegedly orchestrated by the grandest of all grand villains, that traitor to his country, the infernal scoundrel Jefferson. She predicted that the Republican leaders will take ultimately a station in the public's estimation like that of the Tories in our revolution. Although we can never know for sure, there is considerable evidence that Abigail played a decisive role in persuading Adams to support passage of those four pieces of legislation known collectively as the Alien and Sedition Acts. These infamous statutes, unquestionably the biggest blunder of his presidency, were designed to deport or disenfranchise foreign-born residents, mostly Frenchmen, who were disposed to support the Republican Party, and to make it a crime to publish any false, scandalous, and malicious writing or writings against the government of the United States. Adams went to his grave claiming that these laws never enjoyed his support, that their chief sponsors were Federalist extremists in the Congress, and that he had signed them grudgingly and reluctantly. All this was true enough, but sign them he did, despite his own reservations, and against the advice of moderate Federalists like John Marshall. Even Hamilton, who eventually went along too, was at best lukewarm and fearful of the precedent set by the Sedition Act. Abigail, on the other hand, felt no compunctions. "Nothing will have an effect until Congress passes a sedition bill," she wrote her sister in the spring of 1798, "which would then permit the wrath of the public to fall upon their," the Republican editor's, "devoted heads. In any other country, Bache and all his papers would have been seized long ago." Her love for her husband and her protective sense as chief guardian of his presidency pushed her beyond any doubts. She even urged that the Alien Act be used to remove Albert Gallatin, the Swiss-born leader of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. Gallatin, she observed, "that specious, subtle, spare Cassius, that imported foreigner, was guilty of treasonable behavior by delivering speeches or introducing amendments that obstruct their cause and prevent their reaching their goals. Gallatin, along with all the henchmen in the Jefferson camp, should be regarded as traitors to their country." Ultimately, of course, Adams himself must bear the responsibility for signing into law the blatantly partisan legislation that has subsequently haunted his historic reputation. But if, as he forever insisted, the Alien and Sedition Acts never enjoyed his enthusiastic support, Abigail's unequivocal endorsement of the legislation almost surely tilted the decision toward the affirmative. To put it somewhat differently, if she had been opposed, it is difficult to imagine Adams taking the action he did. It is the one instance when the co-mingling of their convictions and the very intimacy of their partnership led him astray. Ironically, the most significant and in the long run most successful decision of the Adams presidency occurred when Abigail was recovering from a bout with rheumatic fever back in Quincy, and the Federalists who opposed the policy attributed it to her absence. This was Adams's apparently impulsive decision, announced on February 18, 1799, to send another peace delegation to France. Theodore Sedgwick, a Federalist leader in Congress, claimed to be thunderstruck and summed up the reaction of his Federalist colleagues, "Had the foulest heart and the ablest head in the world been permitted to select the most ruinous measure, perhaps it would have been precisely the one which had been adopted." Timothy Pickering, the disloyal Secretary of State whom Adams had come to despise, also described himself as thunderstruck and offered a perceptive reading of Adams's motives. "It was done without any consultation with any member of the government, and for a reason truly remarkable, because he knew we should all be opposed to the measure." Abigail herself reported that all the bedrock Federalist enclaves of New England were taken by surprise. "The whole community were like a flock of frightened pigeons. Nobody had their story ready." The stories circulating in the Philadelphia press suggested that Adams had acted impulsively because his politically savvy wife had not been available to talk him out of it. For the preceding 2 months he had in fact complained in public and private that he was no good as a solitudinarian, and he wanted my talkative wife. Abigail had noted an editorial in Porcupine's Gazette regretting her absence. "I suppose," she wrote her husband, "they will want somebody to keep you warm." The announcement of the new peace initiative then gave added credibility to the charge that, without Abigail, Adams had lost either his balance or his mind. Adams joked about these stories. "They ought to gratify your vanity," he wrote Abigail, "enough to cure you and bring you here." For her part, Abigail returned the joke, but with a clear signal of support. "This was pretty saucy, but the old woman can tell them they are mistaken, for she considers the measure a masterstroke of policy." This has pretty much been the verdict of history, for the delegation Adams appointed eventually negotiated a diplomatic end to the quasi-war with France. Adams's decision became the first substantive implementation of Washington's message in the farewell address, as well as a precedent for American isolation from European wars, one that would influence American foreign policy for over a century. In the immediate context of the party wars then raging, however, Adams's unilateral action was politically suicidal. "He has sustained the whole force of an unpopular measure," Abigail observed, "which he knew would shower down upon his head a torrent of invective. As he expected, he has been abused and calumniated by his enemies. That was to be looked for, but in the house of his friends they have joined loudest in the clamor." What Abigail meant was that Adams had chosen to alienate himself from the mainstream of the Federalist Party, which regarded his policy as pro-French, indeed just the kind of decision one might have expected from Jefferson and the Republicans. The editorials in Porcupine's Gazette turned against him. Federalist gossip suggested that their erstwhile leader was mentally unbalanced. Adams, feeling his oats, wrote Abigail that he might now use the Sedition Act to shut down the Federalist press. He was the archetypal illustration of the president without a party. Why did he do it? 3 overlapping reasons appear to have converged in Adams's mind and provided decisive direction to a foreign policy that until then had been vacillating between the incompatible agendas of the Federalists and the Republicans. First, His lingering suspicions of Hamilton developed into unbridled distrust and then outright personal hatred. For 2 years, Hamilton had been issuing directives to Adams's cabinet behind the scenes. Though Adams was vaguely aware of these machinations, he gave them little attention. After all, he never paid much heed to his cabinet anyway. In the summer of 1798, however, Hamilton persuaded his Federalist colleagues in the Congress to authorize the creation of a vastly expanded provisional army, subsequently called the New Army, of between 10,000 and 30,000 soldiers in preparation for the looming outbreak of war with France. Adams had always supported military preparations more as a diplomatic maneuver to impress the French government of American resolve, and he had strongly preferred a naval force, what he called floating batteries and wooden walls. Standing armies struck him as inherently dangerous and expensive items. "Regiments are costly articles everywhere," he explained to his Secretary of War, "and more so in this country than any other under the sun." What possible rationale could exist for a large American land force since the conflict with France was occurring on the high seas? "At present," he observed, "there is no more prospect of seeing a French army here than there is in heaven." Then the whole horrid picture came into focus for Adams. Hamilton intended to make the new army his personal instrument of power. It was a foregone conclusion that Washington would be called out of retirement to head the force, but equally predictable that the aging general would delegate actual command to his former aide-de-camp. Adams suspected that Hamilton, whom he had formerly distrusted and now utterly loathed, saw himself as an American Napoleon, poised to declare martial law and present himself as the available savior. Abigail seconded the assessment, calling Hamilton a second Bonaparte, whose imperialistic designs could only be guessed at. If they had been able to read Hamilton's private correspondence, they would have discovered that his plans were quite grandiose. He hoped to march his conquering army through Virginia, where recalcitrant Republicans would be treated like the whiskey rebels, then down through the Louisiana Territory and into Mexico and Peru, liberating all the inhabitants from French and Spanish domination and offering membership in the expanded American Republic. Although Adams had gone along with the Alien and Sedition Acts, the prospect of a Hamilton-led army marching heaven knows where conjured up the demise of Republican government altogether in a classical last act, a military dictatorship. No one recognized this historical pattern more clearly than Adams. No one, not even Jefferson, hated Hamilton more than Adams. Abigail described the decision to resume negotiations with France as a master stroke of policy, because it averted a French war and removed the rationale for Hamilton's army at one fell swoop. Second, the reports Adams was receiving from John Quincy in Prussia, based on his network of contacts in Paris and Amsterdam, provided fresh evidence that Talleyrand was now eager for peace with the United States. In January of 1799, Adams's second son, Thomas Boylston, returned from Europe with additional dispatches from John Quincy, indicating that Talleyrand would not only receive an American peace delegation, but would also be open to a consideration of compensation for American shipping losses over the past 3 years. However impulsive Adams's February decision might have appeared to outsiders, it was really the culmination of considerable deliberation based on diplomatic advice from his most trusted and strategically located confidant, who also happened to be his son. Third and finally, Adams derived deep personal satisfaction from singular acts of principle that defied the agendas of both political parties. The fact that the decision to send the delegation rendered him unpopular, that it struck most observers as an act of political suicide, only confirmed for him that it must be right. The office of the presidency, as he saw it, was designed to levitate above the party squabbles and transcend partisan versions of the national interest. Even more palpably, the fullest expression of his best energies always occurred when the long-term public interest, as he understood it, clashed with the political imperatives of the moment. The trademark Adams style might be described as enlightened perversity, which actually sought out occasions to display, often in conspicuous fashion, his capacity for self-sacrifice. He had defended the British troops accused of the Boston Massacre, insisted upon American independence in the Continental Congress a full year before it was fashionable, argued for a more exalted conception of the presidency despite charges of monarchical tendencies. It was all part of the Adams pattern, an iconoclastic and contrarian temperament that relished alienation. John Quincy and then-great-grandson Henry Adams exhibited the same pattern over the next century, suggesting that the predilections resided in the bloodstream. The political conditions confronting the presidency in 1798 were tailor-made to call forth his excessive version of virtue. Though Abigail was with him all the way, for Adams himself, it was the supreme collaboration with his own private demons and doubts, his personal declaration of independence. All the domestic and international challenges facing the Adams presidency looked entirely different to Jefferson and Madison. Once they decided to reject Adams's overture and set themselves up as the leaders of the Republican opposition, they closed ranks around their own heartfelt convictions and interpreted the several crises confronting him as opportunities to undermine the Federalist Party, which they sincerely regarded as an organized conspiracy against the true meaning of the American Revolution. "As to do nothing and to gain time is everything with us," Jefferson wrote to Madison, "the very intractability of the French question and the sharp divisions within the Federalist camp between the Hamiltonians and what Jefferson called the Adamites worked to their political advantage. In order for the Republican agenda to win, the Federalist agenda needed to fail." Although Adams never fit comfortably into either party category and eventually acted decisively to alienate himself from both sides, as the elected leader of the Federalists, he became the unavoidable target of the organized Republican opposition. Madison had never shared Jefferson's personal affection for Adams, so it was easier for him to take the lead in stigmatizing Adams's motives and character. There never was perhaps a greater contrast between two characters than between those of the present president and of his predecessor, the one cold, considerate, and cautious, the other headlong and kindled into flame by every spark that lights on his passions, the one ever scrutinizing into the public opinion and ready to follow where he could not lead it, the other insulting it by the most adverse sentiments and pursuits. W, a hero in the field, yet overweighing every danger in the cabinet. A, without a single pretension to the character of a soldier, a perfect Quixote as a statesman. The former chief magistrate pursuing peace everywhere with sincerity, though mistaking the means. The latter taking as much pains to get into war as the former took to keep out of it. The latter point became an article of faith within the Jefferson-Madison collaboration, namely that Adams actually wanted war with France. He was, declared Madison, the only obstacle to accommodation and the real cause of war if war takes place. Jefferson and Madison even managed to persuade themselves that Adams had concocted the entire XYZ affair to mobilize popular support for a declaration of war. Talleyrand, they told each other, was neither so stupid nor so dishonorable to attempt bribery of the American peace delegation. Adams had orchestrated a libel on the French government as part of his swindling experiment. Instead of regarding Adams's decision to delay release of the dispatches exposing the bribery demands as a prudent and statesmanlike effort to avoid a public outcry for war, Madison insisted it was timed to produce maximum damage. The credit given to Mr. Adams for a spirit of conciliation towards France is wonderful, Madison observed caustically, meaning that it was wholly undeserved. When Jefferson half-heartedly suggested that his old friend had once been a man of revolutionary principles, Madison retorted, "Every answer he gives to his addresses unmasks more and more his true principles. The abolition of royalty was, it seems, not one of his revolutionary principles. Whether he always made this profession is best known to those who knew him in the year 1776. Jefferson, in effect, needed to liberate himself from nostalgic memories. Adams was a traitor. Although he certainly knew better, Jefferson went along. He reported gossip in the corridors of Congress to the effect that Adams had been heard to declare that such was his want of confidence in the faith of France that were they ever to agree to a treaty ever so favorable, he should think it his duty to reject it. Adams was, in fact, at that very moment, listening to Jerry's pleadings for a renewal of the peace effort. Another rumor circulating in the streets of Philadelphia caught Jefferson's ear. Washington had leaked the news that he opposed Adams's foreign policy. The exact opposite was true. Washington was endorsing the Adams initiative as the effective implementation of his own long-standing commitment to American neutrality. Yet another rumor had it that Adams was working behind the scenes to scuttle the plans for moving the capital to the Potomac, also untrue. And then, when the president announced his unexpected decision to send a new American peace delegation to France in February of 1799, Jefferson apprised Madison that this event of events had been forced upon Adams. Jefferson had reliable evidence that Talleyrand had threatened to leak the news of his previous peace initiative, thereby requiring Adams to reciprocate. "Mark that I state this as conjecture," Jefferson told Madison, "but founded on workings and indications which have been under our eyes, all contrived. If the primary function of the collaboration within the Adams family was to insulate and eventually isolate Adams from the ideological warfare raging between both political parties, the primary function of the collaboration between Jefferson and Madison was to generate mutual reinforcement for their uncompromising assault on the presidency, frequently at the expense of even the most rudimentary version of factual accuracy. In their minds, the political stakes were enormous. The threat posed by the Federalists put the entire Republican experiment at risk. The battle was to the death, and taking prisoners was not permitted. They convinced themselves that Adams was the enemy, and then all the evidence fell in place around that rock-ribbed, if highly questionable, conviction. Jefferson's nearly Herculean powers of self-denial also helped keep the cause pure, at least in the privacy of his own mind. In 1798, he commissioned James Callender, a notorious scandalmonger who had recently broken the story on Hamilton's adulterous affair with Maria Reynolds, to write a libelous attack on Adams. In The Prospect Before Us, Callender delivered the goods, describing Adams as a hoary-headed incendiary who was equally determined on war with France and on declaring himself president for life, with John Quincy lurking in the background as his successor. When confronted with the charge that, despite his position as vice president, he had paid Callender to write diatribes against the president, Jefferson claimed to know nothing about it. Callender subsequently published Jefferson's incriminating letters proving his complicity, and Jefferson seemed genuinely surprised at the revelation, suggesting that, for him, the deepest secrets were not the ones he kept from his enemies, but the ones he kept from himself. When Congress began the debates over the Sedition Act in the spring of 1798, Jefferson's first fear was that it was aimed pointedly at him. He complained to James Monroe that, "My name is running through all the city as detected in criminal correspondence with the French Directory." Editorials in Federalist newspapers accused him of passing information to the French government through pro-French agents in America and meeting routinely with Benjamin Franklin Bache, editor of the Aurora, the chief vehicle for the opposition. Jefferson privately acknowledged to Madison that these accusations were essentially true. Even though he was the second-ranking member of the Adams administration, he was, as the Federalist leadership in the House described him, the very life and soul of the opposition. Jefferson defended himself by claiming that his consultations with Bache were not clandestine meetings. He had met with Bache many times, true enough, but he was not, as the Federalists charged, closeted with him. More basically, Jefferson simply did not regard his behavior as seditious or treasonable. Indeed, it was the Federalist government, though duly elected, that was guilty of treason. Here was the core of the problem. Jefferson genuinely believed, and Madison reinforced the belief, that the Federalists had captured the government from the American people. Despite its electoral mandate, the programs and policies the Federalists were implementing at the national level, an expansive agenda for the federal government, a version of neutrality that aligned the United States more with England than France, represented a repudiation of the spirit of 76. The passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts, then the creation of the new army, only confirmed that the Federalist agenda violated the central tenets of the American Revolution, conjuring up memories of Parliament's restrictions on the colonial press and British troops quartered in the major colonial cities. How could opposition to such measures be treasonable now when they had been legitimate expressions of American dissent back then? The legal guidelines that might permit a clear answer to that question had not yet congealed. By modern standards, Jefferson's active role in promoting anti-Adams propaganda and his complicity in leaking information to pro-French enthusiasts like Bache were impeachable offenses that verged on treason. But then Hamilton had been guilty of similar indiscretions with pro-English advocates during the Jay's Treaty negotiations. And his conduct in providing clandestine instructions to Adams's cabinet undermined the constitutional authority of the executive branch in ways that would have landed him in jail in modern times. Only 10 years after the passage and ratification of the Constitution, however, what were treasonable or seditious acts remained blurry and more problematic judgments without the historical sanction that only experience could provide. Lacking a consensus on what the American Revolution had intended and what the Constitution had settled, Federalists and Republicans alike were afloat in a sea of mutual accusations and partisan interpretations. The center could not hold because it did not exist. The capstone of the Jefferson-Madison collaboration occurred at this volatile political moment, namely, their joint authorship of the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. Jefferson visited Madison at Montpelier on July 2nd to 3rd to discuss their response to the Sedition Act, which passed the Senate the following day. The Federalists, ironically, thought it was the perfect way to celebrate the 4th of July. They agreed to launch a pamphlet campaign against what Jefferson called the Reign of Witches. Working alone at Monticello, Jefferson composed what became known as the Kentucky Resolutions in August and September. His core argument was that the Sedition Act was unconstitutional because it violated the natural rights of the citizens of each state to control their own domestic affairs. Moreover, each state has a natural right in cases not within the compact, that is, in all cases not specified as under federal jurisdiction in the Constitution, to nullify of their own authority all assumptions of power by others within their limits. Here was the classic states' rights position, topped off by the sweeping claim that federal laws could be nullified by the states, which then had a legitimate right to secede, what Jefferson called scission, if the federal Congress or courts defied their decision. If the Sedition Act was a serious threat to civil liberties, Jefferson's response was an equally serious threat to the sovereignty of the national government and the survival of the Union. Fortunately for Jefferson, the leadership of the Kentucky legislature decided to delete the sections of his draft endorsing nullification, presumably because such open defiance of federal law seemed excessive and unnecessarily risky. Madison's more judicious arguments, published as the Virginia Resolutions, were circulating in the national press and achieving the same goal, condemning the Sedition Act, but without recourse to nullification. In fact, the Virginia Resolutions described the Alien and Sedition Acts as alarming infractions of the Constitution that violated the free speech guarantees of the First Amendment. Instead of challenging the authority of the federal government, Madison invoked the protections afforded by that very government, implicitly suggesting that the federal courts and not the individual states were the ultimate arbiters of the Constitution. Whereas Jefferson's line of thought led logically to the compact theory of the Constitution, eventually embraced by the Confederacy in 1861, Madison's arguments led toward the modern doctrine of judicial review and constitutional guarantees for free speech and freedom of the press. When Madison wrote or spoke on constitutional questions, Jefferson always deferred. To Republican confidants in Virginia, he reiterated his conviction that the true principles of our federal compact left the states sovereign over all domestic policy. If Congress failed to rescind the Sedition Act, we should sever ourselves from that union we so much value, rather than give up the rights of self-government which we have reserved. After a personal visit from Madison in September of 1799, however, Jefferson agreed to soften his stance on secession, not only in deference to his judgment, as he put it, but because we should never think of separation but for respected and enormous violations, or, as he had previously written in the Declaration of Independence, after a long train of abuses. Madison's prudent and silent intervention rescued Jefferson from the secessionist implications of his revolutionary principles and artfully concealed the huge discrepancy between their respective views of the Constitution. The imperatives of their collaboration, plus the need to present a united front against the Federalists, took precedence over their incompatible notions of where sovereignty resided in the American Republic. There are only a few universal laws of political life, but one of them guided the Republicans during the last year of the Adams presidency, namely Never interfere when your enemies are busily engaged in flagrant acts of self-destruction. As soon as the Federalists launched their prosecutions of Republican editors and writers under the Sedition Act, a total of 18 indictments were filed. It became clear that the prosecutions were generally regarded as persecutions. Most of the defendants became local heroes and public martyrs. Madison quickly concluded that our public malady may work its own cure, meaning that the spectacle of Federalist lawyers descending upon the Republican opposition with such blatantly partisan accusations only served to create converts to the cause they were attempting to silence. The threatened prosecution of aliens also backfired on the Federalists when Irish immigrants in New York and Germans in Pennsylvania, formerly staunch supporters of the Adams administration, went over to the Republicans in droves. What Jefferson had described as the reign of witches even began to assume the shape of a political comedy in which the joke was on the Federalists. In New Jersey, for example, when a drunken Republican editor was charged with making a ribald reference to the president's posterior, the jury returned a not guilty verdict on the grounds that truth was a legitimate defense. There was even room for irony. It was while James Callender was serving his sentence for libel in a Richmond jail that he first heard rumors of Jefferson's sexual liaison with a mulatto slave named Sally Hemings. He subsequently published the story after deciding that Jefferson had failed to pay him adequately for his hatchet job on Adams. But this delectable morsel of scandal, which was only confirmed as correct beyond any reasonable doubt by DNA studies done in 1998, did not arrive in time to help Adams in the presidential election of 1800. Indeed, Adams's string of bad luck or poor timing, call it what you will, persisted to the end. The peace delegation he dispatched to France so single-handedly negotiated a treaty ending the quasi-war, but the good news arrived too late to influence the election. Moreover, the new army, which Adams had opposed and then rendered superfluous, had strained the federal budget to a point that demanded new sources of revenue. Even as the army was being disbanded, much to Adams' credit and relief, the cost of raising it landed on the voting public. Adams had somehow managed to miss the political rewards due him and catch the criticism that properly belonged to others. Abigail's earlier characterization of the Adams-Jefferson competition, the oak versus the willow, proved prophetic. Perhaps the supreme example of Jefferson's greater flexibility occurred on the foreign policy front. Throughout the Adams presidency, Jefferson and his Republican followers had been insisting that the French Revolution was the American Revolution on European soil, and that France was therefore America's major international ally. But when Napoleon overturned the French Republic and declared himself omnipotent military dictator, again, just as Adams had predicted would happen, Jefferson quickly shifted his position to accommodate the new reality. It is very material for the American people to be made sensible that their own character and situation are materially different from the French, he observed in 1800, and that whatever may be the fate of republicanism there, we are able to preserve it inviolate here. This was precisely the neutral foreign policy that both Washington and Adams had been urging for a decade, and that Jefferson had condemned as a betrayal of the spirit of 76. Jefferson's conversion occurred with such breathtaking speed that hardly anyone noticed how deftly he was discarding the chief weapon the Republicans had wielded against two Federalist administrations. That weapon was unnecessary now, as both Jefferson and Madison understood, because the superior organization of the Republicans at the state level virtually assured their victory in the looming presidential election. Given this formidable array of bad luck, poor timing, and the highly focused political strategy of his Republican enemies, Adams actually did surprisingly well when all the votes were counted. He ran ahead of the Federalist candidates for Congress, who were swept from office in a Republican landslide. Outside of New York, he even won more electoral votes than he had in 1796. But thanks in great part to the deft political maneuverings of Aaron Burr, all 12 of New York's electoral votes went to Jefferson. As early as May of 1800, Abigail, the designated vote counter on the Adams team, had predicted that New York will be the balance in the scale, S-C-A-I-L-E, scale, S-K-A-I-L-L, scale, S-C-A-I-L-L. Is it right now? It does not look so. Though she did not know how to spell scale, she knew where the election would be decided. In the final tally, her husband lost to the tandem of Jefferson and Burr, 73-65. Though it probably occurred too late to have much, if any, bearing on the results, the most dramatic event of the campaign was provided by Hamilton. In October, he wrote and privately printed a 54-page pamphlet assailing the character of Adams, describing him as an inherently unstable creature, a man driven by vanity and his own perverse version of independence, a pathetic bundle of twitches and tantrums who was unfit for the office of chief magistrate. Adams responded with uncharacteristic calmness to this personal vendetta. "I am confident," he observed, "that it will do him more harm than me." He was right. Coming too late to affect many voters, Hamilton's diatribe exposed the deep rift within the Federalist camp for all to see, and suggested to most readers that Hamilton himself was out of his mind. In political terms, the Hamilton pamphlet was fully as fatal and perhaps suicidal as his subsequent decision to face Aaron Burr on the plains of Weehawken. His reputation never recovered. The same could be said for the Federalist Party. The Jefferson-Madison collaboration was not just committed to capturing the federal government for the Republicans. As Jefferson put it so graphically, their larger goal was to sink federalism into an abyss from which there shall be no resurrection of it. When Madison declared that the Republican cause was now completely triumphant, he not only meant that they had won control of the presidency and the Congress, but also that the Federalist Party was in complete disarray. Though pockets of Federalist power remained alive in New England for over a decade, as a national movement with the capacity to dominate the debate about America's proper course, it was a spent force. Jefferson had not yet invented the expression "the Revolution of 1800" to describe the Republican ascendancy, nor had historians translated that term to mean the emergence of a more authentically democratic brand of politics, a translation that Jefferson would have understood dimly, if at all. Jefferson actually thought that his victory represented a recovery rather than a discovery, a renewal of the principles of 76 and a repudiation of the constitutional settlement of 1787 as the Federalists had attempted to define it. But the more historically correct reality was that no one quite knew what the Republican triumph meant in positive terms for the national government. What was clear, however, was that a particular version of politics and political leadership embodied in the Washington and Adams administrations had been successfully opposed and decisively defeated. The Jefferson-Madison collaboration was the politics of the future. The Adams collaboration was the politics of the past. What died was the presumption so central to Adams's sense of politics and of himself that there was a long-term collective interest for the Republic that could be divorced from partisanship, indeed rendered immune to politics altogether, and that the duty of an American statesman was to divine that public interest while studiously ignoring, indeed remaining blissfully oblivious to, the partisan pleadings of particular constituencies. After 1800, what Adams had called the monarchical principle was dead in American political culture, along with the kind of towering defiance that both Washington and Adams had harbored toward what might be called the morality of partisanship. That defiance had always depended upon revolutionary credentials. Those present at the creation of the Republic could be trusted to act responsibly. And as the memory of the Revolution faded, so did the trust it conferred. Of course, Jefferson could and decidedly did claim membership in the band of brothers, but his election marked the end of an era. The people had replaced the public as the sovereign source of political wisdom. No leader could credibly claim to be above the fray. As Jefferson had understood from the moment Washington stepped down, the American president must forever after be the head of a political party. Neither member of the Adams team could ever comprehend this historical transition as anything other than an ominous symptom of moral degeneration. Jefferson had a party, Adams observed caustically. Hamilton had a party, but the Commonwealth had none. If the very idea of virtue was no longer an ideal in American politics, then there was no place for him in public life. If the Adams brand of statesmanship was now an anachronism, and it was, then the Adams presidency would serve as a fitting monument to its passing. In February of 1800, Adams signed the Treaty of Mortefontaine, officially ending hostilities with France. He could leave office in the knowledge that his discredited policies and singular style had worked. As he put it, he had steered the vessel into a peaceful and safe port. Rather ironically, the last major duty of the Adams collaboration was to supervise the transition of the federal government to its permanent location on the Potomac. Though the entire archive of the executive branch required only 7 packing cases, Abigail resented the physical burdens imposed by this final chore, as well as the cold, cavernous, and still unfinished rooms of the presidential mansion. For several weeks it was not at all clear whether Jefferson would become the next abiding occupant, because the final tally of the electoral vote had produced a tie between him and Burr. Rumors circulated that Adams intended to step down from office in order to permit Jefferson, still his vice president, to succeed him in an effort to forestall a constitutional crisis. Adams let out the word that Jefferson was clearly the voter's choice and the superior man, that Burr was like a balloon filled with inflammable air. In the end, the crisis passed when, on the 36th ballot, the House voted Jefferson into office. Despite all the accumulated bitterness of the past 8 years, and despite the political wounds Jefferson had inflicted over the past 4 years on the Adams presidency, Abigail insisted that her husband invite their former friend for cake and tea before she departed for Quincy a few weeks before the inauguration ceremony. No record of the conversation exists, though Jefferson had already apprised Madison that he knew the Adamses well enough to expect dispositions liberal and accommodating. On the actual day of the inauguration, however, Jefferson did not have Adams by his side as he rode down a stump-infested Pennsylvania Avenue to the yet unfinished Capitol. Rather than lend his presence to the occasion, Adams had taken the 4 o'clock stage out of town that morning in order to rejoin Abigail. He did not exchange another word with Jefferson for 12 years. Chapter 6. The Friendship. Adams correctly regarded the 500-mile trek back to Quincy as his final exit from the public stage. Upon arriving home, he noted that his barnyard was full of seaweed, which then prompted a characteristically indiscreet observation. He had made a good exchange, honors and virtues for manure. When a violent storm struck on the day of his return, he took it as a providential sign that trouble was following him into retirement, as he put it, substituting fermentations in the elements for revolutions in the moral, intellectual, and political world. As one who had helped make those political revolutions happen, he claimed to be completely comfortable in stormy weather. But now, at the advanced age of 66, was it not natural to expect some semblance of serenity? Far removed from all the intrigues, and now out of reach of all the great and little passions that agitate the world, he explained, I hope to enjoy more tranquillity than has ever before been my lot. The trouble with Adams was not that storms seemed to follow him, but rather that he carried them inside his soul wherever he went. Abigail spied him in the field that July of 1801, working alongside the hired hands, swinging his sickle and murmuring obscenities at his political opponents. From his letters we know that Hamilton topped his enemy's list. He called him that bastard brat of a Scotch peddler, who was as ambitious as Bonaparte, though less courageous, and, save for me, would have involved us in a foreign war with France and a civil war with ourselves. Not far behind Hamilton came his former friend and successor to the presidency. Though the hate for Jefferson was far less, the hurt was more. They had done so much together, struggled together against the odds in 1776, represented America in Europe during the 1780s, risen above their political differences during Washington's administration. But during his own presidency, Adams believed that Jefferson had betrayed him and their friendship. And it was all done so indirectly, so craftily, like a burglar who left no fingerprints. Jefferson was a shadow man, Adams now believed, a man whose character was like the great rivers whose bottoms we cannot see and make no noise. When commenting on his other enemies, Adams displayed considerable flair. Tom Paine, for example, came off as the satyr of the age, a mongrel between pig and puppy, begotten by a wild boar on a butch wolf. With Jefferson, however, the colorful epithets and irreverent images did not come so easily. It was difficult to be specific when the core of a man's character was elusiveness. The character of Adams's own complicated feelings toward Jefferson eventually revealed itself through Abigail. The occasion was poignant. In 1804, Jefferson's younger daughter, Maria Jefferson Epps, died from complications during childbirth. Abigail decided to write a letter of consolation explaining that reasons of various kinds withheld my pen until the powerful feelings of my heart have burst through the restraint. She recalled caring for Maria as a 9-year-old girl just arrived in London. It has been some time that I conceived of any event in this life which would call forth feelings of mutual sympathy, Abigail confided to Jefferson. but the loss of a child overcame all her rational reservations. She wanted Jefferson to know that her heart was with him. Jefferson normally had perfect pitch when interpreting the tone of a letter, but in this instance he missed Abigail's clear warning signals and read her words as an invitation to resume the friendship with the Adams family. He seized the opportunity to review the long political partnership he had enjoyed with her husband. Their mutual affection accompanied us through long and important scenes, he wrote, and the different conclusions we had drawn from our political reading and reflections were not permitted to lessen mutual esteem. Though they had twice run against each other for the presidency, he insisted that we never stood in one another's way. The political rivalry had never eroded the personal respect between them. There was only one occasion, Jefferson confided, when a decision by Adams struck him as personally unkind. That was his appointment of Federalists to several vacant judgeships during his last week as president. These appointments, somewhat misleadingly described as the Midnight Judges, had occurred after the presidential election and therefore denied Jefferson the right to choose his own men. The major offense was the appointment of John Marshall as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, arguably Adams's most enduring anti-Jeffersonian legacy, in part because of Marshall's magisterial career on the bench, and in part because Jefferson and Marshall utterly despised each other. But this one offense, as Jefferson put it, left something for friendship to forgive, so that, after brooding it over for some little time, I forgave it cordially, and returned to the same state of esteem and respect for him, Adams, which had so long subsisted. Jefferson's letter sent Abigail into a controlled rage. "You have been pleased to enter upon some subjects which call for a reply," she began ominously. The very notion that Jefferson should feel himself the injured party with the moral leverage to forgive her husband was a preposterous presumption. Now that Jefferson had raised the issue of political betrayal, he would have to excuse the freedom of this discussion, which has taken off the shackles I should otherwise found myself embarrassed with. The pent-up anger poured out. "And now, sir, I freely disclose to you what has severed the bonds of former friendship and placed you in a light very different from what I had once viewed you in." After delivering a spirited defense of her husband's right to make judicial appointments before he left office, Abigail launched a frontal attack on Jefferson's character. Throughout Adams's presidency, she claimed, Jefferson had used his position as vice president to undermine the policies of the very man he had